Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. Our tradition is to first introduce ourselves and then I'll introduce our speaker. My name is Tom Broom.
I'm Daniel.
I'm Lee Robbins.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Jerry Jones.
My name is Mark.
I'm Mark.
Jack.
I'm Brian.
John.
And Amy.
I'm Oswaldo.
I'm Joe.
I'm Richard Azzolini.
Ed, John Stewart.
Peter.
I'm Clint.
And Paul Shepherd.
Lou Patrick.
Baruch Golden.
George.
I'm Roy.
I'm George.
My name is Harley Shapiro.
I'm Terry.
My name is Michael.
I'm Roger.
My name is Eric.
Is anyone visiting us for the first time or returning after a long absence? Our speaker today is Jim Fishman. Jim is a licensed psychotherapist in private practice here in San Francisco. He ran a therapy group for sexually compulsive gay and bisexual men at Operation Concern New Leaf in the mid-80s through early 90s. Jim was co-founder of the Age Action Committee of Massachusetts. He teaches group theory and consults to group therapists. He has a daily meditation practice, and he lived in an ashram in India for 2 years in the late 90s. Jim's topic will be exploring the meanings of sexuality for gay men and the role of emptiness in men who define their behaviors as out of their control. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Hi. I'm going to talk today about sex and the meaning, the unique meaning of particularly anonymous sex and sex to gay men. And I want to preface this with sort of a little bit of a disclaimer that I'm not trying to pathologize or categorize people's sexual behaviors, but for the purpose of elucidating a problem that I find in my private practice and have been working with men who come to me feeling tormented or in despair about their sexual behavior. It's not a this is not a talk that's coming from my own judgment that someone else's behavior is out of their control. It comes from the men themselves. And as you said in the introduction, I did start out working as a therapist in the early 80s at a clinic in Boston called the Fenway Community Health Center, which at the time, when I started there in 81, it had a specialty in treating sexually transmitted diseases, and I was the first therapist who was hired there. And you can imagine in 1981, it was 81, 82, we started to hear about cases of this very frightening disease, which was called GRID at the time, in New York, in LA, et cetera. And as the main therapist there, I would get referred patients who were often either called the worried well or were frightened that they were about to come down with HIV. And on occasion, they did come down with full-blown AIDS. And I was very interested in the topic of how people were responding to the epidemic in the early days. In terms of sexual behavior. So like any major metropolitan city, Boston had its share of outdoor and anonymous sexual places where people could hook up. And so some of the community at the time seemed to withdraw and become isolated and almost, just paralyzed. And there was a whole other population that seemed to step up their sexual behavior, not just who refused to believe that there was a danger out there, even though they were hearing about the epidemic. So I became very interested in that particular population because those are the people who kept showing up at our clinic. And so the topic of anonymous sex is something I want to start with. And before I do, I just want to ask all of you to just call out why you think people, including yourself or others, have sex. So why do you think people have sex? Let's just hear from anyone.
Connection.
Intimacy.
It feels great.
It's fun.
Changes your brain.
It's available.
Tension release.
Validation.
Romance.
Excitement.
Right. So I would say certainly all of the above. And, of course, no one mentioned procreation, I don't think. And so I have this little chart. I have props today. So, and if you can't see these, I will leave these here afterwards on the break. But I'm going to talk specifically about anonymous sex right now. That for some gay men, anonymous sex is a well-adapted part of their lifestyle. It's not, sometimes it's been labeled promiscuous, which is laden with kind of a pathological tone. So I'm not using that. And people who, particularly in the pre-AIDS days, but even now, I think gay men, sex was often the first contact point that we made. You know, you had sex with people, you went to the bars, you went home with someone, and then you might get to know them. And I think that our community, because sex has been so compartmentalized, people like myself who were gay in the 60s, late 60s, I went to a bar basically to pick somebody up. And I went to my first gay liberation meeting in Berkeley in 1970, to pick somebody up. And it turns out I started listening to people and started to connect to people, to my surprise. But so anonymous sex can be part of our culture, whether a person is single or whether a person has an open relationship. And there's another category of men who engage in anonymous sex. And I don't want to say that people only fit in one category. There's some overlap. But this is a gross generalization, but I think that a lot of men engage in anonymous sex because there are no questions asked and there's no commitment. And I think some of our collective wounds as men and as gay men have left us vulnerable to avoiding issues such as the anxiety of a committed relationship where you have to deal with fears of abandonment, control issues, intrusion, competition, power, etc. So anonymous sex can be very convenient for some men who get some kind of closeness, because I think even an anonymous sexual encounter can have meaning for people. As some of you pointed out, it can be validation, it can be a way of, it can be exciting, it feels good, etc. There's also the closeted population who, for this population, and even in the Bay Area today, it continually surprises me how many men are still in the closet or married and hiding that. You know, you would think that in this day and age that wouldn't be the case. But for this group, anonymous sex is one way to gratify their needs with still maintaining their cover. So it's it feels like their only option for some people. And then there's the population that I'm going to be talking about today, which is people who define themselves as having their sexual behavior controlling them rather than them controlling the sex. And it's interfering with their lives in one way or another, whether their health status, their relationship status, their job, etc. And this population also, when I worked at, I moved here in 1985, and I took over a job at Operation Concern, which was then called New Leaf. And I started a group for sexually compulsive gay men. And I interviewed everyone very thoroughly and took a sexual history and found out that there were some amazing similarities. And I don't want to say that all sexually compulsive men have a trauma history, but almost all did, the ones in this group. Oftentimes, there was either sexual trauma as a child, or there was some kind of powerful sexual secret or shame, or either being overvalued for their sexuality as a young child, or that it was, on the other hand, it could also be verboten and forbidden, but also very charged and very present in its absence, if you will. The other population that I noticed is what I call the good boy, bad boy split. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with Carl Jung's concept of the shadow. The shadow is all our unwanted, disavowed parts of ourselves, like greed, passion, lust, etc. So there was another population of what I call the good boy, the best little boy in the world, who was the model son, the one who took care of the alcoholic parents, the one who might have a partner who he supports financially, but who secretly resents all the good things he feels obligated to do. So for this population, sex is kind of the one opening where they allow themselves to operate from the shadow, which is the bad boy takes over, you know, heady with power and disregarding all the rules, throwing all those rules out. So these are some of the profiles of people who define themselves as sexually compulsive. So I ran the group for 8 years, and I'm also talking about people not just who are in this group. I still to this day treat people who deal with sexual compulsivity. But we had a rotating 12-week contract because I figured from the intakes of each man, there were a lot of fears about what I call suffocation anxiety or being controlled or confined. So they could choose whether to stay in every 12 weeks. And actually there was a 4-year period where we had no change in population in the group. And many of these men were abused as children, did not have close friends, never had a dinner party at their house, may or may not be coupled, but their sense of themselves was very shame-filled. I want to take a little sidestep about trauma for a minute. These men would sometimes, there's the word dissociation, which is almost like when people get into a trance state, and the men would say, I don't know how I got to the bushes. I was going to Walgreens. I was buying some Band-Aids. And the next thing I knew, I was in the bushes. I was having sex with someone. I was having unsafe sex, possibly with someone. And then I came to. So this issue of dissociation is frequent with people who define themselves as sexually compulsive. And many of the men also were involved in Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, or Sex Addicts Anonymous, which I have tremendous respect for. In fact, I refer people to these 12-step programs. But it didn't hold them, many of them. Its definition, there was no crosstalk, and they needed to work on their interpersonal issues. And my goal was not to... I didn't kick them out if they had compulsive sex. It was to understand the whys and the wherefores of what was driving them. And could they slow down enough to understand what mechanism was getting them going? So, and I also use the here and now. I use the group as a group process, and it was like an alternative family, that in their families of origin, there were secrets, there was shaming and blaming, but in this group, people could talk openly about their feelings about each other and their feelings about themselves, which were usually pretty awful. People who've been sexually abused, often as children, they have a formidable task because the people who are their caretakers, who are supposed to look out for their well-being, are the ones often who are turning a blind eye or who are enabling the abuse or actually abusing them. So it's pretty shattering and overwhelming when a child has to make sense of his world when this is going on. And so one of the ways that abuse victims make sense of their world is to take on and absorb the shame and the blame themselves. This must be happening because I'm bad. Because I can't tolerate that my father or my mother or my uncle would really be exploiting me and using me for their purposes. So there is a kind of split between the absorbing the bad and the shame versus the parents have to be idealized and are often put on a pedestal. And it took a long time to get people to acknowledge the wounds. Almost everyone in the intake admitted that there was sexual abuse and that it was destructive. But notably, there was one member who, and I'm disguising all the profiles because of confidentiality, but his babysitter molested him continually. And when he was 5, when he was 6, and he claimed that it was only exciting, that it didn't cause any harm whatsoever. He felt like a klutz normally with his body, but he said, this is something I could do. I was good at it. Well, a funny thing came to light in the group, and mind you, this was in the late 80s, and there was the ELISA test by then, but he was not tested, and he admitted that he would go to one of the parks in the city and have unsafe sex with kids, you'd say. Not children, but maybe 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, which is the group he was drawn to. And he was the aggressor. And the group, as you can imagine, started to care about each other and care about each other's behaviors and confronted him. Why are you doing this? This is immoral. You're putting other people at risk. And he got very defensive and said, are you trying to tell me I'm homicidal? And then he felt persecuted by the group and was furious. And as a leader, I don't normally start off the group with an agenda. I let that emerge. But the following week, I started off and said I was very disturbed by this behavior and I wanted to take a look at it. And he was adamant that he was being victimized. And he said, it takes two to have unsafe sex. Well, there was someone else in the group who had kind of the opposite issue, who was having unsafe sex, hadn't been tested, and seemed to be almost playing Russian roulette and almost willing himself to get infected. And something clicked for, I'll call him Mr. A, the one who was the aggressor. He saw Mr. B, who he really cared about, and he finally saw, wow, this is the person I'm potentially infecting. And something shifted, and he broke down and cried in the group. For the very first time, he admitted and remembered some very split-off, dissociated agony and trauma from that sexual abuse. What had actually happened was he went to his mother, who, by the way, was in the mental health profession, who shamed him and blamed him and would not console him. So when he was saying as an adult, you're victimizing me, I'm not to blame, I'm not responsible for my behavior, it was the child's voice that was trying to come through and be healed through his current sexual behavior, if this makes sense. So oftentimes, sexual abuse survivors who engage in compulsive sex or unsafe sex are trying to heal. And the sexual behavior is kind of the symptom that rises to the surface. Am I throwing too much at you? No, okay. So, I have all these props that force me to get these together. I have a diagram. Can you see this? I'll just sort of show it to you. I'll stand up. So this is my map of what we did in group therapy. And if you think of the rungs of the tree, that you start out with the outer core and go deep into the core of what a person's issues are. This could be any addiction. It could be sex, could be food, could be money, could be drugs, could be people addicted to power or fame or whatever. But we're going to talk about that. And I would have people slow down the process and try to just take a few deep breaths, journal if you can, meditate if you can for a few minutes to see what you're feeling when you go out and feel compelled to have sex. Because for this population, sex was not just self-esteem. It could be that. But it was also a self-organizer. And what I mean by that is whenever they felt like their core sense of stability or their equilibrium was shaking, which was frequent, they would go out and have sex. So sex became almost like a form of self-medication. And I really think that the bathhouses, particularly in the pre-AIDS days, acted as kind of a container for many gay men. There were a lot who went for just recreational sex, but it also camouflaged the group that went there because they needed to hold them together. The euphoria of the hunt, there's a boost, there's an adrenaline high, there's the power. And I want to say that sexual abuse survivors, one of the guilty secrets is that sexual abuse is both shattering and powerful at the same time. It's both annihilating and it's also intoxicating in a strange way. And these people have become very sexualized at an early age, and there's power within the trauma that also has to be brought to the surface. So we discovered that what are the catalysts for acting out sexually? Depression, anger, anxiety, guilt, shame, self-hate. And shame, you don't have to be a sexual abuse survivor to have shame. I mean, just think about, I know for myself, the time I grew up, homosexuality was, you looked in a book and it said, see sex perversion. And in the sociology class, we were sandwiched in between, prostitution and drug addiction or something. And I also think that in our culture as men, because we hold the shadow for our culture, we're men who are open to what I call the feminine. And sometimes it's the effeminate or interest that might be ascribed to women. And sometimes it's the feminine in terms of the vulnerability. And think of our culture today. In some ways, the bar culture, I mean, I have a lot of respect for people who work in the gym, but the extreme emphasis on masculinity, if you look in the ads, straight appearing, masculine, no femmes, and I had one person describe about a hookup with someone he met who claimed to be straight, and the biggest put down was, she was the biggest femme on the planet. This is often viewed as, there are hierarchies of who's desirable in our culture even today. So shame exists, even just being a gay man, at least in my generation, you had to deal with secrecy and shame just around that. Now, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. By being in this group, people started to rely on each other rather than on sex. And they began to relate to each other with their clothes on. And they were learning that the self-hate started to, what I call, deintegrate. Not disintegrate, but deintegrate, meaning it's sort of like the Rubik's Cube that had to be reassembled based on a sense of self-love. And I thought they would be happy that they weren't acting out sexually, but in fact, many of them were frightened and went into crisis because, as one person said, at least I knew who I was when I was a sex pig. It was some kind of anchor or compass, and taking that away, while I thought it would be cause for celebration, threw people into a bit of a crisis. And that's the next layer down, which I call the void. Who am I? It's this sense of emptiness, this sense of not knowing. Now, I think people who are... Okay, another prop. Okay. Those of us who are meditators, we're very at home with the world of losing ourselves without being lost. Some of this comes from Mark Epstein, who's a psychiatrist and Buddhist. And, you know, it involves going into that empty core, because we may have an intact enough ego that can hold us to look at the emptiness, and it's a rich territory. And even though we live in a society that tells us not to look at ourselves and not to go inside, we find the richness there, and we push through all of that. But that's probably because some of us, or most of us, had enough, good enough holding environment or safety in our families and have developed a sense of self that is a little more stable. We can endure aloneness. We can feel emptiness. Emptiness for us, or for some of us, doesn't have to be something we have to cure or to get over. We can enter into the emptiness. But for a sexual compulsive person who had no holding environment, who has a fragile bond with parents, they have to face that emptiness. I call it annihilation anxiety. It's like, Jim, you know the saying, you have to have a self before you can lose a self. You have to have an ego before you can let go of an ego. So it's a particularly challenging thing is for people to go into that emptiness. And that's why letting go of a sex addiction or letting go of that identity is terrifying, because they have to face this more than just the normative emptiness, a sense of annihilation. They have to re-experience the annihilation that the trauma brought up, but that has been compartmentalized or dissociated. And Mark Epstein, I'm just going to read you a couple of things here. Two quotes. There's two books. Have any of you heard of this book, Trauma and Recovery? Okay, it's a really good book, and it's about any kind of abuse. And this is what the child has to face, and this is what they have to re-experience in therapy and process with a witness. They need a witness, an other. It can be a community, a 12-step program, and that's why I often see people who come with sex addiction more than once a week, if possible, because the places they have to enter are so young, they may not even have words for what they were going through. So she uses the word she, because she's talking a lot in this chapter about women. This is what the child has to face. The child, in this climate of profoundly disrupted relationships, the child faces a formidable task. She must find a way to form primary attachments to caretakers who are either dangerous or, from her perspective, negligent. She must find a way to develop a sense of basic trust and safety with caretakers who are untrustworthy and unsafe. She must develop a sense of self in relation to others who are helpless, uncaring, or cruel. She must develop a capacity for bodily self-regulation in an environment in which her body is at the disposal of others' needs, as well as a capacity for self-soothing in an environment without solace. She must develop the capacity for initiative in an environment which demands that she bring her will into complete conformity with that of her abuser. And ultimately, she must develop a capacity for intimacy out of an environment where all intimate relationships are corrupt, and an identity out of an environment which defines her as a whore or a slave. So, She also quotes George Orwell, the author who wrote 1984 and Animal Farm. He invented this world, this word called doublethink. Do you remember when they said war is peace and people were kind of, you know, told this means that? So children who've been sexually abused have to obey two opposing injunctions. One is, you didn't see anything, you're going to keep the secret, I'm going to kill you or punish you if you tell anyone, you're innocent. But at the same time, I'm going to desire you, I'm going to use you, you're very powerful, you're sexually enticing, and you're going to be my partner rather than, you know, my child. So there's two opposite experiences that a child has to hold. And so they learn to, again, as I said earlier, own the shame and the blame to make sense of this conundrum. And through the group therapy and through individual therapy, there's a de-shaming process that goes on. I've got a lot of things to say, but I'm going to stop in about 5 minutes and just open it up for questions. Mark Epstein, this is one of his books, Thoughts Without a Thinker, talks about the concept in Buddhism of the hungry ghost, and he says, the hungry ghosts are probably the most vividly drawn metaphors in the wheel of life. Phantom-like creatures with withered limbs, grossly bloated bellies, and long, thin necks, the hungry ghosts in many ways represent a fusion of rage and desire. Tormented by unfulfilled cravings and insatiably demanding of impossible satisfactions, the hungry ghosts are searching for gratification for old, unfulfilled needs where time has passed. They are beings who have uncovered a terrible emptiness within themselves, who cannot see the impossibility of correcting something that has already happened. Their ghost-like state represents their attachment to the past. So I think this is a great picture and metaphor for any kind of addiction. But I don't feel that it's hopeless, in fact. There is a necessary grieving and mourning process that can take place. And it doesn't erase the trauma, but it can erase and it can change and shift the way that each person relates to the trauma. So it becomes part of their history, but it becomes integrated, and they can talk about it, or it can become symbolized. And as a therapist, I'm often the first one to symbolize that to people, or to name it, or to mirror it. There was a man in the sexually compulsive group, you know, he was in his 30s, and it was Thanksgiving, and he said to the group, I'm really dreading going home because I'm going to have to sleep with my mother. And, you know, I said to him, you don't have to sleep with your mother. And he was 35 years old, and it never occurred to him that he could say no. And this is a person with a job. This is a person who, you know, was, you know, in many respects living his life. But it just kind of shocked me. And it wasn't that he was, and again, did he have sex with his mother when he slept with her? Probably not as an adult, but was he sexualized? Yes. And did it, so the boundary crossing, in his mind, he didn't define himself as a sexual abuse survivor. But at age 35, he couldn't imagine not sleeping with his mother. So, This is. I know I'm throwing a lot of clinical material at you, so I just want to ask you all if you have any questions or if you want to comment on anything that that I've brought up. Yeah.
I wonder what role pornography plays in addiction. I mean, at least it's safe sex and not exposing yourself to some kind of transmitted disease. But does this issue come up in your sexual addiction group?
Yeah, pornography and cyber pornography, cyber sex, online, stuff is definitely, I mean, by definition, I don't think pornography or online hookups are compulsive, but anything can be compulsive. And there's definitely people who call me who are dealing with those kind of addictions who, you know, it's really a struggle not to go on, what is it, Adam for Adam? That's one. I don't know if that's not a pornography site. That's more of a hookup site.
Those are two very different things.
Yeah, they're very different. I'm sorry. I'm confusing them.
Again, you're engaged from another person.
So you're saying if someone's going on pornography sites and masturbating?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that. It depends how it's being used. If the person is on the pornography sites 3 hours a day and is neglecting going to work, or they're caught by, you know, it's interfering with their relationship somehow, or they're compartmentalizing all of their emotional needs into fantasy, and then they're trying to stuff that emptiness with something, then that could be very compulsive. But if a person is using pornography because they're tense and they want a tension reliever and they're horny, you know, that doesn't necessarily speak to compulsive. So I think it really depends. And thank you for clarifying that, because hooking up is very different from pornography. But, you know, it definitely can be compulsive. Yeah.
So I'm curious if my own pattern, which somewhat relates to that, but not quite, where it might fit, it's something you haven't quite talked about. So
I'm sorry, which pattern?
Well, I was about to describe my own pattern.
Oh.
So I was sexually compulsive, I would say, for a long period, and in fact was in SLAA for 3 years, though I never fully got with the program, which I stopped 16 years ago. And the stopping it was related to what I eventually came to conclude partially underlay it. It was a form of what I call pseudo-intimacy. So, and all this is while I was in relationships, but I was always, I had a strong desire to be in relationships and was in them, but was, and they were open at that time, but was also in some ways uncomfortable with the closeness. So for me, the drive was to have this feeling of intimacy, but have it not very complete. And so I wonder if that's, is that a typical kind of pattern in this also?
Yeah, so the question is...
And I'm not aware of any abuse in my background.
Okay. Yeah, well, I definitely can see the, you call it pseudo-intimacy, because I take it that it was fulfilling up to a point, that it met some needs, or at least in the moment it purported to meet those needs. I'm not saying it did, but there may have been the hope for it, or it may have initially felt engaging or exciting, and a way to connect. And I think it can be a way to feel alive for some people. Temporarily, you know, and so there is some, you know, even in sexually compulsive behavior, there's a wish to attach and connect, however the threat, however it manifests, definitely. I mean, I think we're all needing connection, and so it is a less threatening way to connect. There's no, you know, if you were my client, for example, I would, if you weren't, you weren't sexually abused, but I would say, well, let's look at what comes up for you in the long-term relationships. Are you feeling suffocated? Are you feeling controlled? Where's that coming from? Were you not allowed to set boundaries? How do you feel about setting boundaries and staying in the relationship? And I would also expect that that would come up in the therapy hour itself, where, you know, if they experienced me in any way as, you know, controlling, you know, that they would speak up to me as a kind of laboratory for a new way to set a boundary. So, you know, I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, it certainly relates possibly. It's something around the intensity and duration issue that...
Yeah. So I think relationships are...
They felt safer.
I think intimate relationships are very intense and challenging for most people. men and women, gay and straight. I mean, you have to tolerate, you have to let down control, and, you know, all the cliches are true. Oh, you're just waving or holding your hand up. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think, thank you, this is a very cogent and helpful presentation. Do you think there's a difference between heterosexual and gay sexual passivity, or that the shame that is more salient among gay people is that generative aspect?
Okay, I have not worked with, I've maybe worked with a handful of heterosexual men who are sexually compulsive, and by far my experience is, you know, much more skewed in the gay men's direction. But the, I think the shame is still there if, you know, if the person is, for example, has a sexual abuse history and is heterosexual, whether they were abused by a male or a female, still there can be tremendous shame. I just think that the gay population has an added overlay of shame anyway.
So, which could be understood as trauma.
Collective trauma. I think there is a collective trauma. I remember in my high school, I thought I was sort of a male impersonator. You know, I tried to pass as straight, you know, like many of us probably did. You know, I sat this way and I carried my books this way and I went to the prom. And my best friend, who, in order to graduate, you had to submit to this terrible ritual to get your yearbook. We went to the assembly hall and there were 10 people on stage who had met in secret, leaving each of us a parting shot of something very humiliating. It was like a hazing ritual that we submitted to. But luckily, my friend was on the committee that was deciding what each person was going to be left, and I wasn't worried. I said, what do they have on me? You know, there was the pregnant girl, there was this. I didn't think they had anything on me. And we were in his car, and I can still remember the upholstery, the smell of the upholstery, as he said to me, Jimmy, they wanted to leave you something really awful, but I made them change it. And you know what? I got your section of the alphabet, so don't worry. And he wasn't going to tell me. And finally, I pleaded with him. And when I heard what they were going to leave me, and if they had left me this, I don't know how I would have responded. I might have had a breakdown. They were going to leave me, and this was 1968 in suburban Boston, they were going to leave me a pair of pink laced underwear. And that, I think, in that context, would have been so annihilating and shaming. I don't know how I would have coped with that. But I think we all have had, or not all of us, but I know for myself, there were little indignities along the way of hiding and having to feel that if people really knew me, this would be, my complete world would blow apart and I wouldn't survive and I'd have to move away or something like that. Right, so I think there is a collective trauma there, too. Yeah?
I wonder if you could tell us something about your experiences with people from different cultural backgrounds. I myself am from Cuba, and just recently went to a meeting in Puerto Rico, a professional meeting for people with PhDs from all over the Caribbean basin. And it was really interesting to me to watch the banter among people from Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, all the PhDs in science, all these heteros assumptions would not happen in professional circles, certainly San Francisco. And, you know, I felt rumblings of my past shame coming out, you know, and the coming out process. I mean, it was nothing dramatic about the experience, but it was really interesting to see how different life is for me in San Francisco as opposed to what I stayed behind.
Well, and yeah, that also brings up in some of these cultures there's a lot of homosexual sex, but it's denied or split off depending on if your position is the top or the bottom. I lived in India for 2 years, and just as I was leaving, I came across a group of gay men in Delhi who asked me if I would run a gay men's group for them. They had never been in therapy, and it was very much, like sex. You could have your little sex on the side with men. It wasn't really considered sex. It was considered mischief. And so there's a double knowing. We know, but we don't know. We won't look. We know it's there. And you know, the sex roles and the gender roles are very rigid in many cultures, more than ours. I don't know if that helps, but I'm just mirroring what you're saying.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to ask something?
Well, it's a little bit connected to that, but a couple things. First off, that, you know, understand that we all have gone through our traumas and our difficulties as gay men. About how your thinking of how study of Buddhism and meditation helps for moderating behavior, not changing, you know, our inner things. We don't have time or money for a lot of therapy groups. And also the experience of being a gay man in an Indian ashram for 2 years.
Yeah,
if
okay.
You can share some of that.
Sure. Well, first let me say that my own path is not specifically Buddhist, although I have my deepest meditations when I come to this group, by the way. But I also think that the self is the self, regardless of the path. One of the things that happened for me in India was I had such a powerful, in my 40s, I had such a powerful spiritual opening that I really neglected the erotic and the sexual and the dating part for a while. Having been very active, you know, in relationships in my 20s and early 30s, and so I really felt that I was doing a split in my own. And actually, one of the things I felt living in an ashram healed for me internally was that split, that the whatever you avoid shows up big time in an ashram. And to me, you know, being in this culture where, you know, it was a very powerful environment, I had to face the erotic and the spiritual kind of in one meditation. They came together. I didn't have to act on it sexually, because you didn't act on it sexually there. But it healed something in meditation, and they stopped being either or, and so that when I came back to America, I didn't have that conflict, that pull inside. In terms of using meditation to deal with the emptiness or the trauma, I would say absolutely. I mean, I teach clients sometimes how to do meditation. I don't tell them it's always meditation. I might give it another name. But being able to go within and to contain the feelings, to watch and observe and develop the witness is very important. So whether they keep a journal or they keep track of it and it brings up a dream that they and a memory, it can be very, very useful. If they can't afford therapy, I would encourage anyone to use meditation as a powerful tool to go to that core, knowing that for some people, they may have to do it gradually and not blow their circuit, so to speak, because for some people it's scary to touch all those levels inside. Or it can bring up that aloneness, that terror of being too alone that they felt as a child.
I think we're just about out of time.
Okay, why don't we take one last?
Great. Thank you very much for what you've offered. I wanted to sort of touch or see if you have any experience with the opposite of compulsivity, which is the anorexia side, which is the shutting down of your sexuality, and whether you consider that the same sort of therapeutic model, and whether it requires a different approach or whatever.
Okay, so the question is about what has been known as sexual anorexia, which is the complete abstinence or lack of sexual contact. Now, I'm not that familiar with people. I have rarely had people come to me saying that that was their issue. So I'm not that familiar with it. I know it exists. But I don't know. I don't know where to put that because I don't know what the underpinnings of that is. Is it a kind of, is it too toxic to touch the sexual self because they'd have to remember something traumatic early on? Is it a fear of intimacy disguised as a sex phobia? I don't really know. So I can't really say that's not my expertise.
Jim, will you be around?
I'll be around if you have any questions. And I'm going to leave my little charts and diagrams here for you to look at if you need to.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
Do we have any announcements? Jared.
Hi. Thanks, Jim, for coming today. Our speaker next week will be our own Baruch Golden. He was here earlier, but probably had to go on a call, so if you're talking.
Any other announcements? Do we have a... Oh, yes.
I just have a comment that I like the chimes. And before we used to use the chimes, and then we got bigger, and we used the super when you're headed... The kettle being knocked in this room is a lot more jolting to me than the child in the meditation. You know, I like when I'm out there, sometimes the host hit the kettle so that we can know that the meeting's about to begin. But that's just a personal comment I want to add.
That's so... we always like feedback. On that point, so at the end of the meditation, it might be a little abrupt if, you know, I like gave it a whack, but what about the strumming if it's... Is that better, or...?
For me, I prefer the chimes.
Okay.
It's just a personal...
Anybody else want to weigh in as long as we have the topic on the corner?
How about if we do the talk now
we're getting into, like, you know, Roy, would you grab a copy of our newsletter for me, please? Do we have a host? David.
We have tea, and we have some snacks. And if you do drink tea, please wash out your cup. And I'll be coming around for Donna Bowl.
Any other announcements before we gather? Well, let's stand and gather in a circle for our dedication of merit.
Power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.